Book designer and author Zach Dodson's debut novel, Bats of the Republic, is simply a beautiful book that needs to be not only read, but handled by its readers. It's an illuminated novel of adventure with hand-drawn maps, natural history illustrations, subversive pamphlets, and strange diagrams. It presents an evocative challenge for us to decipher the book's stories and voices. There's even an envelope that we have to choose to open, or not. As one reviewer called it, a novel with a steampunk aesthetic and a Philip K. Dick heart. This is Media Vox. My name is Maria Engberg, and with me is Zach Dodson. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I will start by simply asking you to briefly describe Bats of the Republic and your work in general as a way to start off our conversation.
Sure. Well, that's a difficult question to start with. Describing my own work is probably the hardest thing for me to describe. But it's a book. It's a novel. It has this element of design, of illustration, graphic design. So I've called it an illuminated novel, which is a term that I stole from another author who makes these kinds of books. But the idea is that storytelling happens in both the text and the visuals of the book. So it's the second experiment that I've done kind of on this scale, and kind of reflects my background as a book designer and an author both. Mm-hmm.
Yes, we do have the pleasure and difficulty to discuss a highly visual work, so we'll try to do our best through this audio-only form. But you mentioned illuminations and visuals, and there's an abundance, a real richness in the materiality. Also, in terms of communication methods, you have letters and books and maps and navigation, and there's a lot of visual and graphic representation of place, which I found provide an atmospheric kind of reading that allow for these visual elements to convey a scene and so on. So how do you go about developing this rich set of voices and registers?
Well, I'm not sure. I hope that most came to me naturally, and kind of the same with the visuals. I think that we're all a lot more visually literate than we realize in terms of design. We take in a lot of this culture, a lot of visual material, especially now in the internet age. So I think that reflecting some of that or regurgitating some of that felt natural in a way. I was very interested in some of those older forms of visual communication, ephemera of telegrams and old letters and the way things used to look. So as a graphic designer, speaking in some of those visual languages was exciting. Mm-hmm.
Did you do any archival work to prepare, or was it, as you said, exciting but also natural to take on that register?
Sure, I looked at a lot of stuff. I don't know if that qualifies as archival work, but I guess in a way, yes, I just looked at a lot of stuff. The copperplate handwriting is based on some heroes of the Texas Revolution, for example, and there was a lot of visual material, of course, that didn't make it in. But as a graphic designer, I think I'm very used to looking around at visual culture and borrowing from that, stealing that even. You see that a lot, I think, in graphic design.
You work now with a large publisher, but you also have a long experience in publishing. Was there any difference in working with a larger publisher in the creative process, but also in the process of publication?
Sure, it was different. But I think I lucked out in a lot of ways. So I started as a book designer when I started my own press in 2005 in Chicago called Featherproof Books. I was just learning how to design, and mostly I started with the covers and laying out books in kind of the more typical way. But as we got more and more interesting authors, and as I sort of developed as a designer, I started designing the interiors of the books as well, and started with the authors kind of making these interiors part of the story or part of the object, or trying to find a way for design to enhance the content and participate with it rather than just be a miniature billboard right on the front of the book advertising the book. I really wanted to do designs that made the books more like themselves or reflective of what they were. A good example of that is a book called Scorch Atlas by Blake Butler, which is a collection of post-apocalyptic short stories. And he said, I kind of want it to look like a textbook. So I made a textbook that looked like it was in the ruined world that it kind of described, you know, just kind of dirty and destroyed and charred and black. We stained the edges of the book black and scanned every page as some destroyed piece of paper. And so that was really fun. It was kind of enhanced the stories, or the visuals were speaking in the same language as the world of that book. And so as I did more and more of that, I was also at the same time working on my own books. So those represent a larger experiment, maybe, in trying to combine the visual part with the text.
So you're describing very well that kind of hybridity that, that I find in your work and others like it. And we can talk about hybrid narratives, or perhaps transmedia or cross-media, multimedia, and all of those kinds of terms. So do you have any thoughts on how the book or perhaps the codex is changing as a medium? Do we need new words to explain what it is that we're doing when we're experiencing or reading and handling a book like yours?
I'm not sure. If there are to be new words, I don't think they should come from me exactly. It's hard for me to turn around and put a critical eye or define exactly what it is that I'm doing. I just know that it feels natural in some way. As a graphic designer speaking in graphic language and knowing the things that it can do to communicate that just words alone can't. And I hope exploiting some of those things in the service of narrative. You know, I think that design and visuals are very powerful and, you know, when combined with storytelling can do some work that text can't do. And so I'm kind of very interested in, I do think that it's a largely unexplored world of book design. I mean, you get a lot of graphic elements and sort of visual storytelling in other media, time-based media, animation or something, or graphic novels, right? Comics have been grappling with this sort of text and image at the same time for a long time. But somehow in book design, the philosophy is always, you know, just the text, this kind of crystal goblet idea of, okay, the pure text comes through, and even the new devices, the e-readers and things, seem to keep this philosophy of the text is primary and nothing else should interfere with it. And I can understand that, that purity, but the fact is, from a graphic design perspective, for me, that's never the case. I mean, even the choice of a typeface becomes incredibly significant and signifies something, gives a voice to the text, something like the margins, how the book is made and bound, I think all add to the experience of the book, the paratext, the stuff around it, is part of reading for me.
Definitely, I agree. And we've definitely moved far from Beatrice Ward's Crystal Goblet, but you also work as a teacher, and you teach hybrid narratives and book design, I gather. How do you approach this as a teacher with your students?
We've just started, where I teach at Aalto University in Helsinki, and we've just started a new master's program in visual narrative. So it's kind of teaching storytelling, creative writing, at the same time as the visual part, design. We look at a lot of these works, a lot of hybrid works across media, and then we try and start to make our own. The students bring their stories, they create stories, and we workshop them in a very creative writing sort of way. And it's generally media independent. So some students are great illustrators, some want to be animators, some are media students who are doing interactive things, or game design students, we get those too. I kind of don't dictate a media and just worry about the story and the experience in whatever media they're creating it in, and that's kind of where we start.
So you mentioned that you found it hard to turn a critical eye on your own work, but I'm going to ask you to do a little bit of that anyway, perhaps. From the context of sort of literary design and media studies and so on, there's a history to this. There's been a lot of experimentation. And recently in scholarship around these kinds of verbal, visual or experimental work, there's been the suggestion that there's a resurgence or a surge in books that that have this kind of combination of words and images. One scholar, Jessica Pressman, calls this an aesthetics of bookishness. And she suggests that digitization is a key component in this, as well as the ease of access of sophisticated digital tools, Photoshop, Illustrator, and cheaper printing, that are sort of elements that come into this bookishness, as she calls it. We can also see it as a kind of final resistance or sort of by the printed bound book against digitization. Would you contextualize your work or see your work against that larger kind of techno-cultural backdrop?
Yeah, I think if you were to level the charge of bookishness at me, that I could hardly deny that based on the work that I'm making. But I suppose I don't have, I suppose it's not accompanied by any anxiety about technology or the culture around that. I certainly can see that trend. I think that there's a small parallel trend in music with the resurgence of vinyl, right, where connoisseurs of music and these MP3s kind of feel like they're missing something in terms of the object or the personality, or they want a physical thing that represents, I know about this and I have this album. So you see vinyl done with beautiful packaging, and, you know, there's some small percentage of the population who's very interested in this. And so maybe the same thing is happening with books. Those who do want books as objects really want beautiful, bookish objects. But it could also be the falling cost of print, the availability of design tools. You do see a lot more of these experiments. And for me, it means that the book, in terms of a paper-printed object, still has plenty of room to grow, and there's plenty of experimentation left in the form, and I think there's lots of things that books do really, really well. I don't think there is that great sea change like you saw in music with MP3s came along, and within a couple of years, CDs disappeared. The numbers for e-readers and e-books, they don't really support that kind of sea change. I think publishers have a lot of anxiety about that, and everybody sort of anticipated that happening. But e-book sales have kind of leveled off now, and they're not that large a percentage of the market. I think that, at least for the moment, it seems like most book readers are sticking with physical books. But I don't have a particular bias. I think both media can do very interesting things and very different things. Like I said, I don't think the book is done with all of the things that it can do as a medium. And that's certainly doubly the case with e-readers and electronic books. I think we're only getting started. And, you know, there are some good examples of what that form could do. But most e-books are not interesting in terms of taking full advantage of the electronic form.
Well, that's definitely true. And when you think about books that do take advantage of the digital form, I think of Steve Tomasula's Talk, which was an early example that now exists in iPad form, and there are plenty of others. Are you tempted to work in digital media?
I am, yeah. I hope I will. I've done it at Featherproof. I did a few short experiments. We had an iPad or an iPhone app for a while called Triple Quick, which were very short stories. But I think I'm gearing up to try another new media experiment. Talk was very interesting, and the designer, Stephen Farrell, with Steve Tomasula, also did Voss, a beautiful printed book that I think took full advantage of that medium and was a big inspiration to me in creating my own work. So I think all of these media have a lot of room for experimentation, and I like these things that take advantage of. I mean, this is why I have a letter in the back of my book, for example. There's no real analog to that in the digital sphere. You can't really to have this thing that's sealed and you're tempted to open it constantly. There's just nothing quite like that. So each media has its own unique strengths that can be played with or taken advantage of.
I'm definitely in favor of that kind of plenitude, and not say that one thing just replaces the other. So it's interesting to hear that. But beyond visually and materially, the role of media drives also the narrative forward, I think, in your work. And I think you share this with other authors. So in Bats, there are a lot of letters, as you mentioned. In other works, for instance, Jonathan Safran Foer's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, there's a tape and various texts. Rafe Larson's The Selected Works of T.S. Spivet has a young map maker, and also the more kind of postmodern and experimental narratives that we've mentioned, like Steve Tomasula's work, also have various kinds of media really at the center of their narratives. So there's obviously this bookishness, but they also kind of revel in media narratively. One reviewer of your reviewers suggested that cumulatively, Bachelor of the Republic becomes a book about the way books are made and the way stories work. and that you are, in the true steampunk rhetoric of this review, exposing gears and cogs whirring in the novelist's imagination. So I was wondering, there's clearly a myriad of, and sometimes irreverent mix of cultural metaphors and an intertextuality, also an intervisuality that's exposed in your work. But what is your thought about media in that regard, in your narrative?
Well, that was a very complimentary review, which I was very thankful for and happy about the way that it was talking about the narrative, as you say. I think that in all of these experiments, the narrative still has to be primary. At least for me, I think that's maybe a personal statement. I'm still interested in the story as the primary thing. And there are other experiments that are looking at the form of things or the interactivity of things. But for me, the visuals are part of the storytelling and do the storytelling work. And the examples that you gave are very interesting. I mean, I think each pair of author and designers, or sometimes it's the same person, author, designer, kind of chooses a different way to have these two things work together. But I'm most interested in those examples where the images aren't just illustrating the text, but they're carrying some meaning, some narrative moment, that they're somehow essential. The text could not be read in the same way if you remove the visuals or you remove the design or the physical object, that it all becomes part of the experience and an essential part of the experience rather than an illustration or a decoration or some just kind of mechanic that's fun to play with.
And I remember also Safran Foer got a review where they called the visual parts of his work a gimmicky. Mm. Maybe this is also a question that we're getting used to more and more of these multimodal works where the visuals are, as you say, not just illustrations, but really integral to the narrative. Do you think that this is going to increase?
Well, I hope so. And it's funny, I think that most readers accept those things very intuitively. We're all very visually literate, and especially with the internet, are very used to images and text happening at the same time and in conjunction with each other. And we know how to read images, and we understand what they mean, like in his work. And for some reason, when it comes to reviewers, there was a great dissertation from Australia that looked at these hybrid novels and actually cataloged all the reviews of that novel among a few others and counted the number of times the word gimmicky, for example, appeared, or the word innovative, or kind of how these things were categorized. But I think one of the insights that came out of that dissertation was that book reviewers somehow feel uncomfortable grappling with the visual part. They either don't feel qualified to talk about that, or they just want to stick to the literary point of view on how a story works. And that's kind of disappointing. I mean, I don't think you need special expertise to take in a visual story. We all go to the movies and talk about them constantly, you know, and these are visual stories in a way, right? So it's interesting, the frequency of the word gimmick with this kind of stuff. Of course, it can be, but anything can be a gimmick, really.
And I think also perhaps in education, we need to take that same lesson to heart, that we perhaps have to teach our students and pupils in school that narratives also include images, and we should talk about the visual aspects of a work as well as the narrative itself.
Yeah, it's hard when teaching in academia not to draw lines around things and create categories and boxes, and I feel like a significant amount of time is now spent erasing those lines or trying to show how comics and novels, for example, don't have to be separate, or animation and film and games could be understood in the same ways in terms of experience and in terms of story.
I have a question about author-designer alter egos. On your website, we find a description, and I'm going to read here. Zach Dodson is a book designer particularly interested in visual narrative. Texan Zachary Thomas is the author and illustrator of Bats of the Republic. Zach Plague wrote and designed the hybrid image text, boring, 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 boring. Neither should be contacted, as they exist only speculatively. Professor Zachary Dodson teaches courses on hybrid narrative and storytelling. So you seem to embrace hybridity in almost a performative way here too. Could you tell us a little bit more about these various alter egos, or is it just kind of having a little bit of fun on your website?
Sure. I think I'm just trying to be funny, you know, but for me, it ties back to the book as an object. You know, when you get a book, especially one that you love, you become so curious about the author, and you have one photo and a sentence that says, you know, so-and-so lives in Santa Barbara with her two Labrador retrievers. And you start to think, what is her life really like? And which characters are the Labrador retrievers? And you want to know more. You start building a narrative. So it really does kind of become part of the story or part of the object. So I think playing with that idea, and then maybe just some jealousy for other art forms. Artists are allowed to do this. Musicians were all fine with Sid Vicious or, you know, taking on names and personalities, and we want them to, right? It's almost encouraged. And then when it comes to literature, there's a lot of anxiety about what's fiction and what's nonfiction, and the line must be very clear, and if it's not, somehow people get very upset by that.
I found it evocative, particularly the Texan part. When I read, and I'm still not finished, so no plot spoilers, about the Republic, Texas looms large, and you mentioned Texan here. Tell me about Texas.
Sure. So that's where I'm from. I was born in Texas, in Austin, and then I grew up in El Paso, which is right on the border with Juarez, Mexico, and the desert southwest. So Texas is a strange place, and a strange place to grow up, especially El Paso. And when I was a kid in Texas, in school, we got a year of Texas history and then a year of American history, and then Texas and then American. So in my childhood mind, Texas and the U.S. were about of equal import. And this is sort of the mentality of Texans. It's really kind of an oversized place and feels like its own country in terms of personality. But I realized once I left Texas that, of course, not everybody had this view of Texas. And I knew all of this Texas history about the Alamo and so forth that, of course, other people were not taught. So I kind of wanted to turn around and look at some of that stuff again, because I think there's another kind of weirder Texas underneath the stereotype of Texas. So the part in the past in my book is set in 1843, which is during this strange little blip where Texas was its own country, and president, constitution, and money, and everything like that. That's a strange moment in history. And so, I just wanted to look at that and think about and show some of the weird Texas underneath, especially of the desert southwest where I grew up, which is, you know, kind of a different ecological place, completely different animals and completely different environment than what most people think of when they think of Texas.
So we've talked a little bit about it already, but I was really struck by something that I found, I think, on your website, where you mentioned the idea designer as author. And I was also thinking about author as designer. What do you make of designer as author? Why do you chose to describe designer as author?
Sure. Well, there's some overlap in activity. And I think when you think about design in terms of planning, right, not just graphic design or the aesthetics, say, of book layout, but design in terms of planning and experience, I think there are many parallels to be made with writing or storytelling. In storytelling, you really have to control the flow of information. And you want to give a reader just enough information and just enough questions to lead them along. You want twists in your story. You want there to be an arc. You want it to be cohesive. A good story feels very natural, but it is usually very well planned or designed, I would say. And since I'm comfortable in the discipline of design, this is how I speak to my students about storytelling and creative writing. You know, I kind of ask them to be designers of stories and move elements around in the same way that you might when you're making a poster. You know, you try it a few different ways, see how it works, see how the elements are playing with one another, and see what creates the most pleasing experience. It is an information architecture, in a way, storytelling. It's a sequenced series of events, and the way that you set that up and the way that you let that play out really creates the experience.
So this is really what I sort of thought of when I read that term, that there's this kind of material activity in creating a story. What do you tell your students more specifically in terms of constructing or creating the architecture for this kind of multimedia work? Do you show them specific models or tricks or how do you work with that more practically or...
Sure. I suppose I do show a lot of models. We have a course called Hybrid Literature, and in that course, we just look at lots of different examples of things and different ways that people have put storytelling and visuals together, all sorts of hybrid ways, in hopes of stealing some tricks and maybe inspiring them. And I think erasing some of those lines that we were talking about, having them think about the story and the experience as the primary thing and not getting caught up in the medium too early. It has to be a book or it has to be a graphic novel. I think if they can leave the media aside at first, they can open themselves up to some of the possibilities of what the story or what the experience can be. You know, I've had students who've realized, well, at this moment in the story, somebody needs to eat a piece of this cake, and let's make that part of the experience, or you know, whatever it is. I think in terms of medium, it's pretty easy to get students to start to switch a little bit, or blend those, or move those around. The harder thing to get sometimes is the story itself, which is a very internal thing, and something that's often very personal. You know, it's this spark that has to come within. It's something that you heard. It's something that you can't let go of. So the idea for the story, where it actually comes from, the seed, that can sometimes be hard to draw out. I think teachers are sometimes hesitant to go into those spaces, into the subconscious, into the black box, and kind of pull out, you know, what's in there in terms of emotion or what you really want to say. But emotion is the essential part of storytelling. If you're not communicating the experience of an emotion, then you're not really communicating, I think. Not really communicating a story, anyway.
So we've been talking about how you obviously published your work and others like your work is coming out. But if we, from your point of view, if we look overall, do you think that publishers are ready to take on these forms on a larger scale? And we also mentioned ebook readers and so on. Do you see that book publishers are interested in taking on verbal, visual, or multimodal works to a larger extent than they have before?
I'm not sure if I can comment for publishers overall. I think that that I got very lucky in finding a publisher that was very willing to produce the work in this way and kind of understood what it was meant to be and how it should be made. I designed it completely before I submitted it, so it went to the publisher in a very similar form to what it is now. So I knew I needed to find a publisher who was willing to take that on. And one of the lucky things about Doubleday, who's the one that published it, they share a production department with Pantheon, who does a lot of the big graphic novels, Chris Ware, stuff like this. So I think from doing those sorts of books and those sorts of experiments, Mark Danielewski and kind of some of the other hybrid books, that they understood, they got it. They were open to this kind of thing. I think other publishers that I showed it to, not so much. I mean, one asked if they could have the file as just a Word document so that they could read it and understand it. And I said, well, you could, but it misses the point, right? You're missing half the story if it's just the Word document. So I think not everybody understands these works. And there does seem to be some hesitation around enhanced books, electronic books. Again, there seems to be a lot of anxiety in the publishing world. I think the anticipation of the MP3 thing, of somehow digital books coming in and taking over everything, has caused a lot of hand-wringing. And it hasn't really happened. But at the same time, I don't think publishers, with a very few exceptions, there haven't been a lot of breakout successes in terms of enhanced books or ebooks. It's a form that really hasn't found its hits yet. they also seem hesitant to take those projects on because they're expensive to develop. They don't really know how to develop them. They haven't done very many of them, and they don't really see a market for them yet. However, I think it's the kind of thing where you have to create the market by making a really original and compelling work. So I'm sure that that will happen sooner or later.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.